is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian bunker, my friends, welcome to your weekly hub for the strange and the unusual, broadcasting from our fortified bunker somewhere deep beneath the dark heart of the Appalachian Mountains. Yes, indeed, I am the mouth of the South himself, Micah Hanks. Welcome, my friends. It is the Grahamian Report. Joining me in studio, Chris Hayes, producer extraordinaire, the man on the microphone. How are you tonight, Chris?
I am fabulous, especially now that I have my container of coffee.
That's right. We all need a container of coffee before we go on the air. I've got the kind of coffee that's so thick you can almost chew the stuff right here with me. And, of course, the man with the kind eyes joining us in studio again. Yes, Mr. Matthew Oakley. Welcome to the program, Matt. Welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be back, guys.
I sense that you were not feeling very good last week, but I'm glad that you're doing better and that you're back with us.
That's amazing that you sensed that, because I was pretty sure I just told you.
Did you tell me that I wasn't supposed to... Wait, hold on. What were you telling me?
I told you that I wasn't feeling well last week.
I was supposed to know. I see. Well, very well.
Instead, you sensed it, so...
I sensed something, but don't call me sensei. My friends, welcome to the program. It's another week of strangeness. In midst of technical difficulties, we are persevering tonight. We had a thunderstorm recently. As a matter of fact, actually, it's that time of the year where I think we just have thunderstorms that come through periodically around the middle of the day every day. I had to do an interview 2 days ago, and literally my second... We have, how many computers have we got? We've got two primary CPUs. One's an auxiliary that we seldom ever use. And then we've got another backup over here, which is a backup laptop if we need a mobile unit. And then we've all got our own laptops. And then the primary CPU. And then there's also the broadcast CPU. So we've got a lot of stuff here in the Grahamian bunker that we utilize. And CPU number two went offline the other day when I was supposed to be going on an interview. And it was just terrible. And I'd been talking with my good friends from our sister podcast, Mysterious Universe, Ben and Aaron, down under, immediately prior to this interview, telling them I'm having tremendous technical difficulties here. And, you know, those guys, if anybody knows about technical difficulties, it's Ben and Aaron. My brothers from other mothers way down under, you know, where it is daytime when it is night here and vice versa. Always good to talk with those fellas, and that was yesterday. And I tell you, Ben and Aaron are so pumped about Paradigm Symposium. If you're not a listener, by the way, of Mysterious Universe, I think probably if you listen to this program, you do know about Mysterious Universe. Ben and Aaron are going to be joining us at Paradigm Symposium this year, and they're so excited, and they're going to be promoting it and everything and talking about this. There's even going to be a Mysterious Universe meetup at some point while they're in Minneapolis this October, so I actually hope to make it out to that. And they're going to, of course, be sitting in on a live broadcast of the Grahamian Report we'll be doing live from Paradigm Symposium. So it's going to be great. You're going to get the best of Mysterious Universe, the very best of the Grahamian Report. Mysterious Universe, they're actually going to be doing their podcast also from Paradigm Symposium. And then the following week, we're going to do a wrap-up where they're going to kind of go over everything that happened at Paradigm Symposium. And I'm going to be the guest on the program that week. So the following week, I mean, literally, it's going to be 2 weeks of podcasting greatness, all centered around Paradigm Symposium. And if you're a new listener to this program and you don't know what I'm talking about, check it out, www.paradigmsymposium.com. This is an event that we are putting on, the Grahamian Report gang right here. We're putting this on in Minneapolis, Minnesota this year, October 18th through 21st. It's going to be fantastic. We're going to have some fantastic people there, not just myself and Chris and Matt, but also Scotty Roberts is going to be there. We've got, of course, George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, who's going to be there, Eric Von Daniken, a lot of fantastic guests who are going to be there, you know, of course, Ben and Aaron of Mysterious Universe, and so many others. So this is truly something I'm personally looking forward to. Can't wait. Hope to see you all there, and you can learn more about that at www.paradigmsymposium.com. Now, that said, it's been a very busy week for me. I've been working on a new book. Of course, a few people know about this book. If you haven't learned about this book yet, might as well go ahead and tell you. This thing's coming out later this year. It's called The UFO Singularity. It's a fantastic idea, I think. And fortunately, my publishers thought it was a fantastic idea as well. Chris here is rolling his eyes. He's saying, oh, we got to keep this guy in check. But in addition to these dudes in the studio here with me, I've got a fantastic editorial staff. There's an art and concept design, a layout staff, you know, all the promotions department. And then there's an entire separate agency that handles the actual marketing angle of all this. And I tell you, when you work with major publishers, there are so many people who work so hard with this. And I'm so thankful for people like Michael Pye and Laurie Kelly Pye. And of course, we've got all the other fine folks up there at New Page Books in New York, who are helping to get this out. You'll hear more about the UFO singularity later this year as well. And then finally, something you're going to hear about on the program, maybe even a little bit on this edition of the program, is H.P. Lovecraft, because I'm working on a new article that's going to be in a special edition of New Dawn magazine later this year. And so, and I'm rambling all this out, you know, and just spouting this off the top of my head right here at the beginning of the program, because I've worked all day on this writing stuff. And when you're a writer researcher, it's hard to quote unquote come off the clock after spending about 8 hours writing and researching and then not have these kinds of things. They permeate your psyche in a sense, you know, and so there's this kind of a lingering psychic presence in my mind that has to do with, you know, forbidden futuristic technology and UFOs. And then, of course, H.P. Lovecraft. And I think that personally, H.P. Lovecraft, he created a fictional mythos that was based on a lot of ancient humanity, you know, and the origins and the supposed deities and the presences, the non-human presences, okay, that existed in ancient and early human or amidst ancient and early human civilizations. I think a lot of people take for granted that the research and the theories of people like Eric von Daniken is in all truth very, very heavily influenced by the writing of H.P. Lovecraft. And, you know, a few people have actually even said this guy may have been more in tune with stuff that was going on than people even realize. So that said, I'm digging into this a little bit, and maybe I'll tell you a really interesting story about H.P. Lovecraft a little later in the program. But first, let's get to some emails. We have folks who've emailed us this week, and I always like to try and go to the listener emails and answer questions when I can. It's getting to a point where I can't answer questions via email and otherwise. I've got so much stuff going on that, you know, we have to do this on the air.
Real quick, though, does this have anything to do with cosmic love?
Well, do you have a bucket of water you're going to pour on my head?
Yeah. Well, I started to say, Chris, get it ready.
Chris, I always have cosmic love.
Well, I know you always have cosmic love, and that's really good to know, but, you know, sometimes we don't like being... Can I finish?
Put a lid on it.
Do you have a pen, Micah?
There you go.
Okay, well, initially, I was going to say, it's nice to know that you've got it, but not all of us like to be beaten about the heads and neck with it.
Oh, stop that. You know, I got an email from a listener, actually, recently saying, one of my emails was read on the program, and I was mortified because I was afraid that what I had said may have been misunderstood, and I wrote him back and I did say, listen, no, we have a lot of fun with that sort of thing. And so if anybody, you know, if you write me, here's what I want to put out to people. We invite people to write us here at the program, and if you do, it's easy to reach us, info@graylianreport.com, okay? Graylian, that's Graylien report.com. So you can email us there. You can also reach Chris and Matt. It's producer@graylianreport.com and engineer@graylianreport.com for Chris and Matt, respectively. But if you want to reach me directly, my personal email address for this program and otherwise is info@graylianreport.com. Now, that said, I do invite people to email me, but if you email me with regard to something that you've heard or that you would like to discuss pertaining to this show, don't email me unless you expect to have your email read. I can't read every email that is sent to us on this program, but I will read the ones that stand out every week, and that's what I try and do. I try and pick at least, time permitting, two or three emails that I can feature on the program each week. And so if you send me something, just expect it's going to appear on the program. Now, if you send me an email and you say, in no way, shape, or form do I expect this to go out over the air, and Mr. Hanks, I would presume that you would please honor the confidentiality of this transmission and not read this on the air, that's fine. Then we won't talk about it on the air. Otherwise, if you email us, expect it's going to go out on the air.
Oh, I didn't even know anonymity was an option.
Are you anonymous?
I couldn't tell you if I was. That would defeat the purpose, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, later we're going to be talking about Anonymous as well on the program, because, you know, they've been making news again. You know,
are they anything like Harpo?
Who's Harpo?
I don't know. Who's Anonymous?
Somebody asked me who Harpo was recently.
Well, he's one of the Marx Brothers.
I think they were actually talking about the, what is it, High Altitude Auroral Research Project. Is that it?
Well, HARP? That's just HARP.
Yeah, so if you add an O to it, Project Operation was... okay, anyway.
And let me tell you, I know a few people who are actually, not kidding around, terrified of the prospect of HARP. They think cloud seeding is like a big deal and happening and all over.
I know a lot of people. I mean, Look at the program we're doing here, you know. I think I mentioned on the show last week that Brad Steiger, I got a copy of the second edition of his conspiracies and secret societies, the complete dossier. I really want to get Brad on the program sometime soon to discuss that. Around the time that I met Brad several years ago, the first edition of that book had been put out by Invisible Ink Press. It delves into a lot of that sort of stuff. And yes, there are a lot of people who think that there are, you know, that these chemtrails, and we've talked about this on the program before, that there is a distinction between chemtrails and contrails left by jet aircraft. But there are people who think that, indeed, that there are different substances, and maybe even biological agents of various malintent that are released into the atmosphere by various aircraft, and that, indeed, that they are used to control not only the weather, but also the populace, and also, of course, various aspects of the food supply. So, and I'll just tell you, folks, you know, we've gone back to a two-hour format with the actual weekly podcast, because we're trying to minimize, maximize, make more efficient various aspects of the program. I mean, there are definitely a lot of things that we're changing about what we're offering on a weekly basis with this program. I'm hoping that there's going to be some new content that we will be able to make available to people in addition to the weekly program that will focus on these kinds of things. So keep that in mind. And in the meantime, you can always learn more at www.graylianreport.com. That's the website. We post every podcast there, and also there are articles and news and other information that you'll find there as well. That said, going to the emails, and if you do want to email us, again, I'll say, just assume that this may be read on the air if you send your information along. Patricia writes, "Hello, Mr. Hanks. I just heard you for the first time on Wolf Spirit Radio. I'm glad that we have listeners out there who have found us via other programs. I do a lot of programs." She said, "I found your interview very interesting. I live not far from Minneapolis, and I would be interested in attending the Paradigm Symposium to hear some of your speakers like yourself. Is there any chance, however, that Mr. Joseph P. Farrell will be an invited speaker?" Good question. You know, right now, Joseph Farrell is not on our roster, but God forbid, in the event that anyone had to jump a ship for Paradigm Symposium, I'd love to take into consideration having Joseph P. Farrell. Just a couple of months ago, we featured Joseph as a guest on this program discussing his new book, Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops. And I'll tell you, that was one of the creepiest interviews I've ever done. I'll tell you this, too, and I don't think I've ever talked about this on the program. When I was conducting the interview with Joseph that night, I remember, because it was a pre-recorded interview, and I did that when I was here in the bunker by myself, and I remember... This is just incredible. I remember doing the interview with Joseph Farrell, and at one point I hear this loud drumming noise in the distance. And I'm thinking, well, who knows what that is, but it gets louder, and it gets louder, and it gets louder. And finally, I realize what I'm hearing. There's a helicopter, which is weird because we're hundreds of miles below ground, so you shouldn't be able to hear that anyway. But nonetheless, I hear a helicopter outside, overhead. And it's loud. I mean, I'm talking loud like a Chinook, you know, like a twin blade helicopter. And it gets so loud, I had to kill my microphone at one point while he's talking. And all I could think of was, oh, God, now we've done it. They've found us, you know. That was an enigmatic interview with Joseph Farrell. What he was talking about, the content, of course, he was talking about the Nazi International and psychological warfare that's been used to mislead the public and how that relates to UFOs and all this stuff. It was just an incredible interview. He is a fantastic speaker, a fantastic researcher. And so, yes, I'd love to. And if we can't get him this year, maybe next year, since I'm periodically in touch with Mr. Farrell, maybe we can get him involved in a future event that we put on related to this program. So thanks for that, Pat. Tom writes, "Hi, Michael. Once again, you were provocateur supreme on your recent edition of the program. I heard your interview with Mr. Tom Fusco, and I found it fascinating. I've heard him on a number of occasions and have actually exchanged emails with him a couple of times, but something that he said last time struck me in a different way than in other interviews that I have heard. It pertains to his description of the potential propulsion system for UFOs. Now, while I concur that his postulation regarding propulsion systems satisfies most of the anomalous effects observed during those incidents, he does not speak to motivation, nor, he states, does he attempt to discern what that motivation may be. His postulation does, however, lead one to open the possibility to a motivation that I have not heard having been considered, and that is this. Many researchers in the UFO field have previously noted that UFOs show a particular interest in atomic facilities. Many of those researchers also attribute an altruistic motivation to it. You know, we've had Robert Hastings, brief aside here, on the program before, who also says that he feels that whatever these UFOs are, the fact that they watch these nuclear facilities may not be such a bad thing. Well, Tom writes, as you may have already garnered, I ascribe no altruism to their motivation at all. It stands to reason that if they were trying to save us from ourselves, then why wouldn't there be the same frequency of observation at biowarfare labs or other conventional military manufacturing facilities? There must be something peculiar, maybe specific to nuclear functions, that's not found in those other locations. And so I wish to pose it, if Mr. Fusco's hypothesis is correct, it may relate directly to the collateral effect of nuclear explosions, or rather the what we might say the indirect, the byproduct of these explosions. And of course, Tom is referring to electromagnetic pulse, or EMP. He says, it only stands to reason that the craft were using electromagnetic fields of some sort as their propulsion, and therefore that an EMP might radically affect the integrity of their system. In point of fact, we have no way of determining whether or not an EMP pulse remains localized. Could it in some way traverse dimensional barriers as well? I'm not sure whether any study has been done of that nature at all. Very interesting questions, Tom. As long as I'm letting speculation run wild, like this theory also may account for the reason that UFOs seem to appear in greater abundance in remote areas and in isolated mountainous terrain, both locales which would be likely to have a minimum of electronic smog, perhaps the kind resulting from the harmful effects of electromagnetic fields. Very interesting questions, and who knows what that link is, but it is true that indeed, if you read the work of Robert Hastings, he wrote a book called UFOs and Nukes that linked UFO sightings specifically to nuclear sites. And furthermore, of course, you know, we have nuclear ballistic missiles and things like that that are occasionally used in times of conflict. Of course, we remember what happened at World War II and what ended, of course, the conflict. Well, in the book UFOs in Wartime, author Mac Maloney also puts forth the theory that UFO sightings may increase during conflicts, during times of war. And if that's the case, what exactly is going on here? Is it truly that we are dealing with some sort of an extraterrestrial intelligence that doesn't want us to harm ourselves? Or would we have to accept the potential that maybe what we're dealing with is a variety of phenomena much closer to home than a lot of people realize? Think about it. If UFOs, for instance, were based right here on Terra Firma, well, they would have a lot at stake in the event that we wiped ourselves out, wouldn't they? We'll talk about this more. And much more, in fact, when we come back here on the Graylian Report. As a parent, you can't help but look at your child and wonder what the future holds. You may dream about the possibility of your son or daughter becoming a professional athlete or a renowned heart surgeon. But while you're dreaming, consider this. The odds that your child will be diagnosed with autism are 1 in 110. Knowing the signs of autism and getting an early diagnosis could make a world of difference to your child and to you. To learn the signs, visit AutismSpeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report, your home for right and reason in an unreasonable world. And let me tell you, it is unreasonable out there these days. You know, here we are in an election year, and I'm hardly even following, you know, the candidates, the potentials going on. And I won't ramble about this for long, but I was talking with Chris about this before the program. I mean, bless his heart, we've got a president right now who's running for re-election who hasn't really got a whole lot to run on. Let's just face it.
Hang on real quick. Before you get into this, I just want to, you know, to appease everyone who's listening, just go ahead and don't mention Ron Paul. Okay, just I know we're talking politics, and politics is fine, but don't mention Ron Paul. Ron Paul is the name that we don't want to talk about. Okay?
Which one now?
Ron Paul.
Ron Paul, huh?
Ron Paul.
Hey, one more time.
Not Rand Paul, but Ron Paul.
Oh, okay.
That's right. Yeah.
Ronald Paul.
Let's.
His name is Robert Paulson.
Oh, God. Well, yeah. You know, a lot of people think Ron Paul's out of the race. He's actually going to stay in until the convention in August. But here's the deal. So, yes, we've got a commander-in-chief who's running for re-election, who really, unfortunately, hasn't really got a lot to run on. I think it was The Atlantic that carried an article the other day talking about how if you look at the criteria right now in American politics, and they set forth all these different reasons why, essentially, for the last maybe couple of decades, you know, essentially presidents don't get a whole lot accomplished while they're in office. That seems to certainly have been the case for Barack Obama.
Well, I mean, if they're good, they can get a lot accomplished.
Well, you know, but again, coming back to the idea, we were talking about wartime in the last segment.
Or at least competent.
Well, here's the thing. Looking at the last couple of decades. Okay, well, but all that said, again, love him or hate him, Barack Obama hasn't really got a whole lot to show for his last 4 years. And then we've got Mitt Romney coming into the situation, but we also see the political vitriol going on right now, that is being associated directly with the Republican Party, and unfortunately, our home state here, the Gralian home state of North Carolina, with this this vote that just took place recently, the overwhelming majority of which supported. Well, Chris, why don't you go ahead and tell us about this, because I know that this is near and dear to your heart, and of course you've drawn a lot of criticism for this recently.
Wait, no, I just was going to say that you're wrong about him not accomplishing a lot or having anything to run on. There's a garden at the White House.
Okay, there's a garden at the White House.
That grows vegetables.
Okay.
Not just flowers.
People, it's important that we have a garden that grows vegetables at the White House.
Yes, like cucumbers.
Michelle and I wanted to be able to have cucumbers at the White House. No, it was the gay marriage amendment here in North Carolina, though, that was, of course, a big issue. And personally, now here's my feeling. I'm a guy who likes to try and truly hang in the middle of the road. I used to work for a political talk radio program. Well, several, in fact. I was a producer of a progressive leftist talk radio program, and of course I had affiliates and people who I corresponded with daily on the other side of the hall who were producers of a more conservative-leaning kind of libertarian program. And I have really gotten information from both sides, and there are times where I can see the good and the bad in both. And what I learned was after, you know, going through my own process of learning and accumulating knowledge and whatnot over the years, that I pretend, rather than looking at it as being a fence straddler, I want the best of both worlds position, I see that the moderate center is probably just a better place to ground yourself from, which then you can propel yourself toward the issues that do matter and which are brandished by logic and not instead, of course, by mere dogma and, of course, the D or the R that people tend to vote for as opposed to, you know, again, what I think is a logic-oriented decision. Now, that said, again, I've become rather disheartened with American politics in recent years, and it's kind of a shame to me that I see so much political vitriol stemming from the politicization of issues right now, of course, it being an election year, particularly by the conservatives. So it's just a real shame to me because we don't see a whole lot on one side, and then we see what I really consider not non-issues, but issues that are distracting us from more concerning issues on the other side, and they're just playing them against one another to the point of doing what? And now here's the thing. I don't profess to have an answer here. What really are they trying to get at? What are the two political parties in the United States really achieving right now? Not a lot. I don't think either party has a whole lot to show for anything. There hasn't been a lot of enthusiasm about Mitt Romney. There hasn't been a whole lot of enthusiasm for the last entire 4 years for Barack Obama. And yes, Ron Paul, of course, has not managed to really break the seal, so to speak, in terms of getting a lot of popular attention in the media. And I think the political system helps with that to an extent. And so, yes, we're left with these two kind of mainstream conventional choices. And again, I'm just terrified that we're going to end up in a situation like we did, well, not like we did 4 years ago, but like we are now, in which we won't have anything to show for it. And so people ask me, what are your feelings about politics right now, Mike? And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to keep looking at UFOs. And I'm sorry, that might sound like I'm just dodging the issue, but the truth of the matter is I think that there's so... And speaking of Joseph Farrell, by the way, when you do look at the stuff that's going on behind the scenes, I don't agree with everything that Joseph P. Farrell writes, but I do think that there's a lot of truth to his notion of there being elements going on, factions, if you will, behind the scenes of the mainstream political and governmental organizations that we all know about in day-to-day life. When you really look at what may be going on and you see the factual data that backs that up, I see a lot of this political vitriol and these non-issues that are put forth and just brandished like swords in an election year. A lot of it is just this Hegelian dialectic of, hey, let's get these people to fight against one another and get them away from the real issues that are underlying all this. And therefore, the American public, or anyone else, globally for that matter, the majority of the populace is unaware of what's really going on. And that's why, again, I gravitate back not only to the center, but also to a spiritual, talking about cosmic love, a spiritual and, I think, a philosophical viewpoint in which let's worry about bettering ourselves. Because sometimes, honestly, I think the machine is so broken, there's little we can do to fix things outwardly. And I'm not telling people not to go vote. I've always advocated getting out there and voting. If nothing else, that exemplifies our abilities, what's left of our abilities, to exercise our rights as citizens. But let me tell you, folks, although I think you should vote, and I think that's important philosophically, I don't think that vote's really going to amount to much.
Micah, I'm going to have to ask you to stop, because it appears you're giving some of our guests in the chat room the vapors.
Am I giving someone the vapors? Oh, that's code, isn't it? Duke is Thompson. Thompson is co. Wait. Never mind. Okay.
Well, if you don't mind me interjecting for just a second, you were talking about the American people not backing one candidate or the other, and not a lot of momentum for Romney or not a lot of momentum for Obama. I think this moment, not literally this moment, but the past month and forward, this is when you're going to start seeing a whole lot of support one way or the other, because this is when the Romney campaign can focus on, you know, instead of focusing on the peripheral candidates like Gingrich or Santorum or something like that.
All of whom are no longer in the race.
Yeah. Who, peripheral candidates that they no longer have to focus on. They've got their targets set on Obama, and likewise for the Obama campaign on Romney. Mm-hmm. So you're going to see these more focused attacks, these more, you know, on the other party, and people are going to start drawing more and more opinions and backing one candidate or the other.
So what are you saying, Matt?
I'm saying that you said that there wasn't a lot of support either way.
But you're repeating me. Stop repeating me. No, I'm messing with you. I'm messing with you. No. I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. And here's the thing. Again, I think what you're saying is that there are going to be parties that are playing against one another. I refer to this as a Hegelian dialectic in which Americans are put in a situation where they are given two likely alternatives. Okay, type A or type B. And if you disagree with largely what one or the other says, then you take sides, okay, with the side of your choosing, and then you launch your attacks at the other group, and people are focused on attacking one another as opposed to looking at the root of the problem to begin with. Chris, I'm sorry, what was that?
Oh, I just was going to... You said there are several parties, and I have yet to be invited to a single one.
We're working on that, guys. We are going to have some parties.
They're not your kind of parties.
Yeah, they're not the parties. Trust me. You know what? The kind of parties...
They're all my kind of parties.
Oh, you want to go... You want to go hang out at Bohemian Grove is what you want to do.
Hell yeah, I do.
Oh, God.
I mean, if for no other reason, then could you imagine how wild that gets? I mean, sure, decide the fate of the world when I'm not there, but I want to rock out.
Chris, that's the problem with you, man.
With my tie on.
That's the problem with you, man, is that you're too eager to get in there with these globalist cretins that are wanting to control. They want to control everything that we have out there. They want to... Do you know what it's like?
Don't you want to control everything? Isn't that, like, the basest human desire?
I'll tell you a couple of things. Here's what's wrong with America today is there's too many people like you that want to get out there and you want to hobnob and elbow with the stars and elbow with the political elitists, the globalists that want to take over the world, that want to drink their cocktails, they want to drink their whiskey, they want to drink their vodka, they want to drink their wine, they don't want to get... You know what? They don't care about you. They don't care about blood spilled on the streets. They don't care about children.
You don't give whiskey to a god!
Micah, you're getting worked up. Joker makeup is running.
Hold on. Well, I got to mellow out for a minute. I just blacked out. Where am I? Whoa, what just happened? Whoa.
You're like one of those cartoon characters who has the birds flying around their head, except you've got clockwork elves.
I think I'm okay. Matt, you were about to say something, buddy. Sorry.
Well, I just started to say that's exactly why Chris wants to go, is so he can have a secret meeting with the clockwork elves.
And I also want to give too much whiskey to a god.
I'd like to see
see what happens.
Because I have yet to find a substance that can kill me. So, I mean, if anyone can do it, possibly they can.
I'm sorry, what does happen when you give whiskey to a god?
Not just whiskey, too much.
Well,
whiskey.
We'll see. This precedes giving too much whiskey to a god. Basically, the god's like, you know what? There's mercury in these vaccines. I don't care. I'm going to the Tet bar. I don't know what Tets are. I guess they're in Vietnam. I don't know. These are Vietnamese gods.
T-E-double-T.
Yeah, Tet. The Tet bar. But that's where too much whiskey is given to a god. So I guess we need to go to Vietnam.
Okay, we're going to Vietnam, you know. And actually, speaking of conspiracies, I do have to say, we mentioned Anomalous. Anomalous, I'm sorry.
Anonymous?
Yes, Anonymous was the one I meant.
Who's Anonymous?
What we do is we start our own clandestine group of hackers, and we call it Anomalous. We are Anomalous.
Or we can be Synonymous.
We are synonymous with Anomalous, but not anonymous. Okay, you got it.
No, we'll totally tell you who we are.
Don't buy the hype.
I'm Chris, and I'm in your computers.
Yeah, that's right. He is post-singularity already.
I'm messing up your YouTubes.
You know, Gizmodo.com carried this story this week where, I kid you not, Anonymous has said that they have access literally to every secret government database. All right. This is that's a bold statement. Yes, I know. We'll get to that in a moment. They have been meek and quiet.
But that's just like the secret governments, not the governments we know about, right? They only
They say that they have access to databases in the known in all branches of known government.
Okay? Oh, okay. So they don't have anything from the secret government.
That's, I think, exactly what people are missing here is people think they attribute all this dark stuff. Okay, all this dark matter, well, not dark, okay, I'm about to get into a big semantic trap, so I'm going to stop right there, but...
They have access to all the cosmic love and dark matter that doesn't exist, ever.
I think dark matter is the opposite of cosmic love, Chris.
Well, that's why they have both of them.
Okay, well, now, do you know about this guy, Christopher Doyen, okay, who is known otherwise as Commander X? He had been known as Commander X...
When he was anonymous.
When he was anonymous, but he's no longer anonymous, exactly. He's the coop has been flown, that's right, and blown, and here he is, Christopher Doyen, we know his name. Now, he is apparently self-exiled at present. He has gone to Canada to try and escape the wrath of the Fed. Here's what's happened, okay? And this came about, this discussion came about in an interview with the National Post recently. He was busted for hacking a California government website, and he eventually sat down with the National Post for an interview to talk about this. Now, the exchange circles, mostly around Doyen's exile to Canada, as I'd mentioned, where he's hoping to kind of escape some of the pending issues that the U.S. feds are hoping to enact against him for hacking into government sites. But now, he said something rather interesting right toward the end of this interview, and that is the following. They asked him, they said, what's next for Anonymous? So here he is, the cover's blown, Commander X, a.k.a. Christopher Doyen, is talking, and he says, right now, we have... an this is exactly what he says. We have access to every classified database in the U.S. government. It's a matter of when we leak the contents of those databases, not if. It's a matter of when, not if. You know how we got access. Here's how we got access. He says we didn't hack them. He says the access was, get this, given to us by people who run the systems.
Well, see, I've just lost all respect for Anonymous or anyone even related to them, because honestly, when you have a card like that in your hand, why in any deity you choose or to worship's name would you tell anyone, like, hey, we have this super awesome secret weapon, you want to know what it is, because we're going to tell you. Well, and then it won't be secret anymore.
I'll tell you this, in all the James Bond movies, the villain always, right before the plot fails, tells everything and lays all his cards out on the table.
So are you comparing Commander X to Blofeld?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I was confused about who Commander X actually
Blofeld
was.
Blofeld has a cat.
Now listen, here's the thing. Commander X back in the 1970s, okay? Well, maybe not the 1970s. Let's bring this forward to the 1980s and 90s. My good pal Timothy Green Beckley, a.k.a. Mr. UFO, had published a lot of books under the pseudonym. Well, he didn't publish the books himself, but he published books by an individual who used a pseudonym known as Commander X, okay? And a lot of these books had to do with underground military bases. And so when I saw this story today about this guy, Christopher Doyen, who used this moniker, Commander X, I was thinking, wait a minute, hello, couldn't be the same guy. So I emailed Tim Beckley today, all right? And I asked him, I said, any relation to your Commander X? He said, there is yet another Commander X who was recently arrested on some charge I can't recall. And then he said, demons are coming through my TV screen right now. Oh, crap, it's just a Netflix vampire movie. but that's Tim Beckley, a.k.a. Mr. UFO. Tim, if you're listening right now, I've got to get you on the show sometime soon. He's a good pal. And no, it was not the same. It was not indeed the same Commander X. This is a different one. But other people are asking the same thing. Why exactly are we dealing with a group like Anonymous? And if you recall, WikiLeaks did the same thing last year. They claimed that they had all this information, but that they were sitting on it, and that in the event that this or this happened to people who are coordinators or involved otherwise with WikiLeaks, in the event that the crap hit the proverbial spinning turbine, okay, that they would release all this information, and it would be sent to news sources worldwide and all these different people who are subscribers, all this stuff. Well, Gizmodo, okay, had a staff writer talking about this who said, on the face of it, this is an absurd claim. The claim, again, being that we have access to every classified database in the U.S. government, and if you want to know how we got access, well, we didn't hack them. The access was given to us by people who run those systems. They say, did someone literally from every government agency sell out to Anonymous? All of them? Even one cachet would be a huge feat. But all of them, it reeks of a tall tale, particularly from an organization with a serious credibility problem. And then we're reminded of when Anonymous said a while back, hey, remember when they said they were going to end Mexican drug cartels? Interesting. Very interesting. Well, with that, we are a little late on a break, but then again, after all the technical difficulties we've been sustaining tonight, well, who the hell gives a crap about time anyway? Time, I want you to look me in the eye right now. Look me in the eye. You and I got some talking to do. Lucy, you got some explaining to do. And with that, we'll get back to explaining what's really going on when we return here on the Grayley Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay tuned. Back to the program, wrapping up this hour of the Grayling Report. So yeah, exactly what's going on there? Does Anonymous really have access to government databases in every aspect, in every formation, in literally all areas of the known United States government? And if they did, here's the question too. If they did have that kind of access to databases that various branches of the U.S. government, okay, were keeping from the public, if they had access to this kind of information, what would we expect would be released by those kinds of actions? If these hackers could get in there and get this kind of information, what would they have? Would it be UFO disclosure that we would expect to see? Would it be the truth about the Kennedy assassination? Would it be the real dirt behind what was going on during World War II? What would we expect to really see? It's kind of a difficult question. Who knows what would really be going on? What kind of information, if anything, we would actually really be made privy to? I'm a little skeptical. And frankly, right now I'm a little skeptical as to whether or not Anonymous actually has that information. But as we've said before, and we'll say again, maybe we'll wait and see what kind of cards end up face up on the table here before long. That wraps up this hour of the program. When we come back, we'll be diving into more mysteries of the unexplained. What about those Easter Island heads? Is aging a disease? We'll look at the idiocy and the fabrications, according to Smithsonian Magazine, about ancient aliens, one of my very favorite subjects, and of course, how you can ward off sharks using magnets. All this and more on the Graylian Report when we come back. Stay tuned.
The 9/11 memorial is for the 343 firefighters who didn't make it.
For my husband who died that day.
And the first responders who saved my life.
Because the best of humanity can overcome the worst hate.
This is Robert De Niro. This year, as we open the 9/11 Memorial in New York City, we ask that you join us to honor, remember, and reunite. To learn more or to reserve your visit, go to 911memorial.org.
Brought to you by the 9/11 Memorial and the Ad Council.
What can we learn from our ancient past? What is the mystery behind UFOs? Did aliens visit humankind in ancient times? Each of these tests the very boundaries of humankind's ability to reason, and all will be explored this year at the Paradigm Symposium 2012, October 18th through 21st in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Speakers will include Eric Von Daniken, author of Chariots of the Gods, George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, as well as Giorgio Tsoukalos, Bill Burns, Philip Coppens, and many more. Tickets are selling fast, so reserve yours online today by visiting ParadigmSymposium.com. Reviewing our past and changing our future. For more information, visit ParadigmSymposium.com.
Theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
Welcome back to the program. Second hour of this week's edition of the Graylian Report. And I'm your host, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, broadcasting from the Graylian Bunker hundreds of miles beneath the Earth's surface, down here in that dark disquiet known as the Mohorovic Discontinuity. That's right. Here amidst the creepy, hellish little Hadals and all those cave bats and things that do tend to dwell within the hollow earth, we are happy to brave such perils to bring you knowledge and insight from beyond the fringes. That's right, that's what we do every week here on this program. It is the Graylian Report. Welcome back, my friends. I'm so glad that you could join us this evening. And we have so much on the table, as always. We always have so much that we want to try and delve into, whether it be dreams from within the witch house or, well, globalist conspiracies that seek to take you down and keep you unhappy. We wouldn't allow that kind of a thing to happen, would we? Not at all. I was saying as we were going out during the last break, you know, that I think Time and I have to have a talk, a serious talk. And interestingly enough, I found this story at Reuters.com recently asking a rather peculiar question. Is aging a disease? And this is serious, like in the literal sense. Is the actual physical process of aging something that we could consider a disease that afflicts humanity?
Well, I mean, you can die from it.
It can kill you. It's debilitating. You know, the human tendency to gravitate toward the natural state of entropy. It is interesting, isn't it? So the question is aging a disease? It's clear that the simple fact of growing older, chronological aging, is indeed relentless and unstoppable. There's very little that we know right now in science that we can do in terms of stopping the aging process. But experts studying the science of aging say that it's time for a fresh look at this, not only as a biological process, but one which recognizes it as a condition that maybe could be changed or manipulated, maybe even treated and delayed. What if we could offset the effects of aging? Well, taking this new approach would turn the search for drugs to fight age-related diseases on its head, they say, and could speed the path to a market for drugs that would treat multiple illnesses like diabetes, heart disease, and Alzheimer's at the same time. If aging is seen as a disease, it changes how we respond to it. For example, it becomes the duty of doctors to treat aging. You know, we've always, since time immemorial, we've accepted aging as just a natural part of life. Many embrace it. But this is interesting because David Gems, a biogerontologist who spoke at a conference on aging in London last week, gave a lecture called Turning Back the Clock. Now, at the moment, drug companies and scientists keen to develop their research on aging into intangible results are hampered by regulators in the United States and in Europe who will license medicines only for specific diseases. It may be difficult to get the scientific establishment at large to view aging as an actual disease, a condition that is causing, of course, problems for humanity as a whole. And because aging is not viewed as a disease, the whole process of bringing drugs to that market can't be applied to drugs that would potentially treat aging. This creates a disincentive to pharmaceutical companies to develop drugs to treat it, according to Gems. Now, the ability of humans to live longer and longer lives is being demonstrated in abundance across the world. Think about this. Everybody that you know is living a little longer than their great-grandparents did. And their great-grandparents may have lived just a little longer than their great-grandparents did. You know, I know my grandparents right now are both in their 90s, and I spent Sunday, Mother's Day, over there with one of my three favorite mothers in the entire world. My grandma's one. My mom, in fact, is one. It'd probably be really bad if my mom wasn't one of them. Yeah, there's probably another mother out there somewhere.
Well, you said three. One of your three favorite mothers.
I did. Three favorite mothers.
Is Mother Teresa the other one?
No, silly.
The Virgin Mary's mine. Never mind.
Yeah, that's your favorite mother indeed. Well, but the thing is that, again, my grandparents are both in their 90s. And they've led healthy lives. Neither of them have ever smoked. Neither of them have ever consumed alcohol. Chris and Matt. But I'll tell you this. My grandparents are also very bright and positive, optimistic people. They don't get down, you know. Grandma fell and broke her hip a while back. And she's just doing fantastic. You know, she recovered. She's on a walker, but she's happy. She was certainly happy to see me on Sunday, and that made me feel great. But, you know, people 50 or 60 years ago, they weren't regularly. This wasn't average for people to live into their 90s and to be functional and to be aware entirely and operating, you know, when still in their 90s. My grandparents are both entirely lucid. They're able to get around for the most part. They have a little trouble. They have hearing aids and things like that, but they don't have, you know, I mean, they're not hooked up to life support and stuff like that. They live at their house, and they live happy lives. So, obviously, somewhere along the way, things have begun to change, and people are living a little longer and a little longer. Average life expectancies extended by as much as 30 years in developed countries only during the 20th century. And now, get this, experts expect that the same or more will happen during this century. In other words, in the next 100 years, all of us, if we take good care of ourselves, moderate, if you're going to drink alcohol, moderate alcohol consumption. If you're a smoker, we'll cut that out right now. If you're not eating healthy, if you're doing if you're doing fast food all the time, cut that out. Start eating spinach and vegetables. Take care of yourself, and you could live to be into your 120s, or maybe even longer, maybe your 130s. But then again, that's all taking into consideration, as I understand it, if there aren't actual treatments that are put forth to treat aging as a disease.
But why would I want to completely reverse my current lifestyle the way you just described it when I could just be injected with nanobots when when Kurzweil invents the singularity and makes it happen single-handedly.
Hold on. You said when Kurzweil invents the singularity?
Yeah, you couldn't hear the sarcasm in my voice.
I mean, a lot of people say he already has invented the singularity.
Well, yeah, he invented it, but it's not going to happen.
I would disagree. I think that it was invented. The concept of essentially there being a singular point in our future during which the rapid rise of technological growth as a civilization, okay, the human species we're talking about, our rapid rise of technological prowess begins to grow more quickly than we can even perceive, which will likely, of course, involve some sort of artificial intelligence. Okay, when we think about things on those terms, that concept has been around for a long time, that the rate of growth of technology is increasing, not just, you know, more and more and more. It's actually greater than exponential growth that we're seeing. And if that's the case, and here's a good example of that, Chris. Well, during show prep today, before the program, we were talking about how, what was it like back in 2002, you know, a 4 or 5 megapixel camera was really a big deal. I mean, it was really hot if you had, like, you know, 4 or 5 megapixels on your camera.
Yeah, I knew all kinds of people who loved this thing that didn't even look a quarter as good as the film they could still buy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, because it was convenient. It was technology. It's kind of like iPods and iPhones and things like this that stream music now. It doesn't sound as good.
Yeah, but I can see the picture now.
Exactly.
Sort of.
People have instant access. They have it, you know, anywhere they want to go. They can carry it around with them. And actually, it comes right back to photography again, because here's the whole thing. Let's look at maybe back by around 2008. You know, I think maybe we were seeing, you know, 9, 10, maybe even 11 megapixel cameras that were really, really hot. And now, think about it.
Well, and now the camera on my phone is better than the camera just a few years ago I spent $400 on.
How many megapixels is that?
It's 12. I have a 12 megapixel camera on my phone. Why?
Well, think about that. You know, your phone, you have a phone. It's not a camera. It's a phone with a camera. And you carry it around in your pocket, and that thing exceeds...
I prefer to think of it as a camera with a phone.
Well, you're a photographer, but the point I'm getting at here is that thing exceeds the capabilities of the best cameras that existed less than a decade ago. Digital cameras, at least. You know, and that's a camera that's built onto a phone and everything else. I mean, smartphones, that's the whole thing. The name is misleading. They shouldn't be called smartphones. They should be called smart devices, because they're really a multi-tool that include a phone and a camera, and they include a planner, and they include a video game system. You know, they include web browsers. They include all this stuff. You know, they're not just phones. We refer to them as phones because they began as cell phones, but really... The cell phone industry has gone toward, instead of using phones, they've gone instead toward this concept of, you know, a multi-tool that we carry around with us, and the multi-tool happens to have a phone on it. That's all your cell phone actually is. And the reason I bring all this up during this conversation about aging is this, okay? If indeed technology continues to grow and grow and grow and grow at a greater than exponential rate, we've seen this kind of thing happen already with quote-unquote cell phones, which are no longer really just phones. Well, if people really want to ward off the effects of aging, now I know that it's one thing to be able to manipulate technology. It's another thing to be able to manipulate our own biology, you know, to dig into our own genetic structure, to dig into our neural pathways, the biological processes that constitute what we are and who we are and how we are as humans. I know that's a different thing. But as our understanding, our greater than exponential understanding on a year-by-year, hell, a day-by-day and week-by-week basis, as we continue to harness better and better the applications, the technological abilities to manipulate ourselves, will we get to a point where we will be able to change fundamentally who and how we are? And maybe how long humans are able to live. Again, the average life expectancies of humans extended by as much as 30 years in the last 20th century, at least in advanced and developed countries. And they're saying that the same thing could happen in the next 100 years. Boy, I tell you, it could be a lot more than 20 to 30 years. It would be 20 to 30 years in the event that we don't create advanced technologies that literally are just conducive to, for all I know, granting virtual immortality to people. That's what Kurzweil and these guys are talking about when they talk about singularity. Now, a study published last year by Danish researchers estimated that more than half of all babies born in wealthy nations since the year 2000 will live to see their 100th birthdays. Again, my grandparents are in their 90s right now, and 30 or 40 years ago, that was highly uncommon for people to live. I mean, you were older than old if you lived to be in your 90s, and now a recent study says that half of all babies born in wealthy nations since the year 2000 will live to see their 100th birthdays. More than half, in fact. But with greater age comes a heavier burden of age-related diseases. Cases of dementia and Alzheimer's, incurable brain-wasting conditions, are expected to almost double every 20 years to around 66 million by 2030 and over 115 million in 2050. Again, I think in the event that we don't have technology that will counteract the adverse effects of those kinds of things. But it's not just those sorts of situations. We also see diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and the cost of coping with them in aging populations. Well, those are also set to rise dramatically in coming decades in rich and poor countries alike. Now, Nir Barzilai of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University in New York says that one way of trying to face down this enormous burden of disease is to look at the biggest risk factor common to all of them, which, again, is the fundamental thing underlying all this, and that's aging itself. There's one thing everybody is missing, he said. Aging is common for all these diseases, and yet we're not investigating the common mechanism for all of them. We're just looking at the specific diseases. In other words, let's tackle the underlying issue, and those diseases go away. If humans don't age, then the ages or the diseases that come with the onset of age begin to diminish as well. So he says to try and reverse that, to try and reverse aging, Barzilai and many other scientists around the world are studying the genes of the very old and starting to find genetic mechanisms or pathways that they say help them beat off the dementias, cancers, heart diseases, and other age-related illnesses that bring down others who die younger. I have to say, Chris, that this is a Reuters article, but based on the action that you're performing over there behind your microphone, that was a poor choice of words by our Reuters news source.
That's
there.
A really awesome service that they provide.
What? You don't want to help them beat off the dementias and cancers and heart diseases and other age-related effects?
No, I mean, I don't want to do it, but whatever you're into, that's fine.
Do you think this is a laughing matter?
To beat off cancer?
We want to help science beat off these diseases. We want them gone. Matt's laughing too. What? I don't know.
I mean, okay, fine. I'm for the beating off of any cancer or dementia or whatever science needs to beat off. Let's just beat it off.
You know what, Chris? I think you're being nasty. I don't like that. I don't like that. That's even nastier than the ill effects of age. But I'm telling you, in the coming decades, my friends, technology may beat a lot of things. Technology may change fundamentally, not only the world around us, but it may change aspects of ourselves. We'll delve into this and many other mysteries when we come back here on the Graylian Report.
Ranger Station.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting in the forest.
Uh-huh.
1 second I'm having a smoke. Next thing I know, I'm face-to-face with Smokey Bear.
Wow.
And he told me it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
Did you know 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans?
I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous and you're not. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Micah Hanks of the Graylian Report here. Today I want to talk to you about Intrepid Magazine, the new leader in clear and reasoned thinking in an unpredictable world, and the official magazine of the Graylian Report. Intrepid features the latest in-depth analysis of science, culture, conspiracy, politics, and unexplained phenomena. You'll get expert commentary from an incredible cast of seasoned writers and researchers, as well as interviews and insights from some of the biggest names in the field. And best of all, you can subscribe today for just $14.95. It's Intrepid Magazine, boldly going. Subscribe today by visiting IntrepidMag.com, and coming soon, look for Intrepid on Nook and Kindle e-readers. You know, this story over here at the dinosaur tracking blog, nested within, of course, Smithsonian.com. Matt and I were laughing. We were laughing at this before the show tonight. This is so funny.
That's right, without you, Chris.
Yeah. Brian.
I was laughing.
Brian Swidick at the Smithsonian.com blog. He's writing, I love this. The title says it all, my friends. It's the Idiocy, Fabrications, and Lies of Ancient Aliens.
Whoa. Is he calling into question the integrity and credibility of, like, the entire staff of Ancient Aliens, or, like, the concept of Ancient Aliens, or just Giorgio Tsoukalos, or, like, Bill Burns, too, or, I mean, what's going on?
Well, admittedly, the blogger in question had not actually read, oh, I'm sorry, not read, he had not actually watched the program Ancient Aliens until fairly recently. This is what just killed me. The way that he words this is so beautiful. And this is what Matt and I had a good laugh about. I'll just go ahead and read this to you. He says, until now, I have assiduously avoided Ancient Aliens. I had a feeling that if I watched the show, which popularizes far-fetched, evidence-free idiocy about human history, has been molded, and of course, by extraterrestrial visitors no less. He said that I felt that if I ever watched this program, my brain would jostle its way out of my skull and stalk the earth in search of a kinder host.
I mean, hang on. I just want to take a quick poll, and you guys can email me at producer@greyalienreport.com with your answers. Do people actually watch Ancient Aliens? I mean, I've seen every single episode because it's awesome, but do people actually watch Ancient Aliens for anything other than sheer entertainment? Do you believe what they're saying? Because if you do, then you're watching for the wrong reasons. Hair like that isn't there to inform. It's there to entertain.
The point, I think, yes, is that it's this, that when it comes to Ancient Aliens, obviously, I'm sorry, let me actually rephrase that. It's not just Ancient Aliens. I think when it comes to television in general, what you're going to be dealing with is largely entertainment, okay? It's largely entertainment. And therefore, yes, I take all this with a grain of salt. Now, will Giorgio Tsoukalos, and for that matter, George Nori, Eric Von Daniken, you know, William J. Burns, and many other people who have appeared on that program, will they all be at this event I am hosting with Scotty Roberts Minneapolis this year?
We are hosting?
Yeah, I said we are hosting.
I am hosting!
Well, I said that for emphasis.
That's what you said.
Since you guys are doing so much work to help me plan this thing.
Hey, who got Newtons on board, huh?
You didn't get Newtons on board. Where are the Newtons? If you had gotten Newtons on board, I would not be hungry right now.
I forgot to tell you, Nabisco has sponsored us to the tune of $150,000.
Well, really? Well, then all my worries have gone away, I suppose, because I don't have to worry about ever having to buy another pack of Newtons. No. Not that we need that kind of sponsorship, because you know what? No, but in truth, I tell you, the thing is that regardless of whether or not Newtons are on board, I'd love to have them on board, but the truth is that we do already have a lot of virtually all the key players that appear on Ancient Aliens, they're all going to be at Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis this October. Now, the point is, if I didn't buy into, and let me just say, I don't apply blind faith to anything. I realize that program is largely geared towards entertainment. But I think that there is, especially with regard to, and we've talked about this in previous editions of this program, there's a lot of merit to what guys like Eric Von Daniken say. There have been a lot of questions about things he said also. But there is certainly merit to the philosophical questions surrounding the general subject matter that he puts forth in his books. In ancient times, were there things going on here on planet Earth that may have influenced who we are today? And is this a worthwhile consideration in terms of understanding or understanding better about, you know, who we are and how we came to be here on this planet? Now, I don't say that I believe with certainty that aliens came here in ancient times, but is it a possibility? Well, who the hell was there 65 million years ago when dinosaurs were roaming the Earth to see what was going on, you know? We learn what we can from the fossil record. We learn what we can about the ancient world from archaeological evidence that we're able to uncover, but we can't tell conclusively what was actually going on because we were not there and we were not observers.
So are you saying there's no conclusive proof?
I'll tell you this, yes. I believe that there is very little conclusive proof to substantiate such things as there being, for instance, well, okay, I'll just put it like this to you, okay? When Giorgio on the program says conclusive proof, he's often talking about conclusive proof of there being ancient visitors of the extraterrestrial variety. You know, something I like to refer to generally as paleo contact. No, I don't think that there is conclusive proof of that. Okay, in other words, I don't prescribe to the idea of I think, therefore, aliens, the popular meme that we see all over the internet these days. Not at all. But is it wrong to suppose that maybe at some point, you know, I've spoken with a number of accredited, what are you doing over there, Chris? Are you trying to burn the bunker down?
Maybe. But it's rock, so I can't.
Matt, turn his microphone up, man, please.
Yeah, turn my mic, thanks. Well, I have a question, you know, in regards to the whole entertainment aspect of the show. Maybe we have an unfair advantage because we are in the entertainment industry, and we know that literally every single person in the industry, you do it, I do it, Matt does it, Giorgio Tsoukalos does it, Philip Coppens does it, anyone on any television show or radio program presents a character.
Yes, exactly.
And while the show may be silly, Eric Von Daniken in person and Giorgio Tsoukalos in person probably make some really good points.
Yeah.
But really good points don't get ratings.
Exactly. That's the whole purpose behind Paradigm Symposium. Is I think that we have a great group of thinkers who, given the... Look, I've been there. I've been on television before, and I've dealt with the circumstances that television entails in which you are told, well, make it look good for the camera.
And I mean, in the 70s, Carl Sagan flew around in a fake spaceship around the universe.
You have been watching Cosmos.
I mean, come on, really? Carl Sagan, like the premier astrophysicist ever, lowered himself to being in a fake spaceship flying through the universe to make things like quantum physics accessible to everybody. No, he wasn't being super serious, because you can't be super serious.
In other words, you have
TV.
To dumb down the good ideas, essentially, so that everybody can kind of relate to it. Matt's waving his hand over here. What was
great
it?
Great idea,
engineer?
For a flick. Carl Sagan.
In space.
Well, replace
that was
replace,
Cosmos.
Replace the kid from Flight of the Navigator with Carl Sagan.
What is Flight of the Navigator?
Oh, come on, Chris.
Flight of the Cosmologist. Flight of the Radio
Mike
Cosmologist.
Knows what I'm talking about.
See, basically,
Flight of the Navigator. Yeah, you know, the story about a kid, you know, who basically a UFO lands or something, and the kid the kid makes friends with this alien robot thing and goes flying around on the spaceship. But,
well, what you guys don't seem to understand, and I don't know why, because I've explained it to you several times, up until I was about 16, I didn't really do anything like watch movies. I pretty much watched Jeopardy and the History Channel and the Discovery Channel. That's all I did. I didn't have friends. I just learned.
That's why we're way cooler.
That's why I've never seen E.T. I'm going to put it out there to the world. I have never seen E.T., and I have no plans to watch it.
Well, I'm really disturbed by that.
I've also never seen Bambi.
Well, I can't blame you for not wanting to watch that one, but with E.T., I have to say, you know, that was one of those seminal works, you know, back during the 1980s that dealt with, I mean, in a highly fanciful, you know, and you know, idealistic way. The notion of extraterrestrial visitors to Earth, which again, you know, I know it pisses a lot of people off, but I'm not necessarily a proponent of, again, what we would call the ET hypothesis, the idea that Earth is being visited by extraterrestrials. You know, I was going to bring this up earlier. In fact, hang on.
Okay.
We've got right here the new issue of UFO Magazine. I've got it right here in my formerly nicotine-stained hands. Wait,
are you also behind your golden EIB microphone?
I was going to make another joke, but you didn't let me finish there. But anyway, yes, it was a Rush Limbaugh reference. Anyway, so I've got my copy of UFO Magazine here with Kevin Randall on the front, and Kevin Randall, I heard him during a recent edition of the Paracast program, and I'll just tell you, it was a fascinating interview. And at one point, Kevin Randall said that although he has studied abduction, maybe secondary to UFOs, and I'm the same way. I'm not a UFO abduction researcher. You know, John Mack and Bud Hopkins, and to an extent even Whitley Strieber, and people like that have been known as UFO abduction or alien abduction researchers over the years. I, on the other hand, am a UFO researcher. But a lot of people don't draw a distinction between UFO phenomenon and alien abduction. And the reason why is because I think it goes all the way back to the UFO investigations by the, you know, the early, you know, the Air Force and the and the U.S. Army, and of course there were intelligence agencies that were somewhat interested in this as well. Following the Second World War, we saw these investigations that were being performed by primarily the Air Force and then also other agencies with regard to this UFO problem. Edward J. Ruppelt, of course, coined that term. He was in the Air Force and wrote that book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. Coined the acronym that we use to this day, UFO. And it didn't say Unidentified Flying Alien Spaceship. No, it was UFO, Unidentified Flying Object. These were apparently intelligently controlled, technologically designed aircraft of some variety that were seen flying around. We didn't know what these things were. And actually, if you look online, if you get on YouTube and you look up Carl Sagan's earliest interview, it's an interview with a very young Carl Sagan, probably maybe in his late 20s, early 30s at the most, and he is sitting there talking about, guess what, UFOs. It was indeed something that during, up until the late 1960s, with that, with that charade, with that, I have choice words I would use for it, but that we'll call it that circumstance for now. I'll be kind, known as the Condon Committee or the Colorado University UFO Project, that was largely based not on trying to actually understand the UFO situation, but dissuade the public from paying attention to it, to take the problem away from the hands of the U.S. Air Force, and to regurgitate it to the scientific community as something that was largely considered, well, not really worth their time. That's really what that Colorado University UFO project did, the Condon Committee. That's C-O-N-D-O-N. Chris, get your mind out of the gutter. But Edward J. Condon and these guys, when they went about trying to solve the UFO mystery, and this is the thing, this is proven by memorandums that were found to have been released by project leaders. What was the guy's name? Robert Lowe, I think, who was one of the project coordinators, who had said that basically if we put this off to the public in such a way that it makes it look like we played down the idea, that we're not really trying to find any evidence of saucers, and then we look at psychological evaluations of those who claim that they have had these sightings, we can maybe not only dumb the entire idea down, but we can also play the thing off to our advantage. These are the kinds of things that these people, in memorandums that were later released, were telling one another from within this so-called Condon Committee there at the University of Colorado that were overseeing this UFO project. These were supposed to be men of science who were objectively looking into the UFO enigma. It was anything but objective that they did, and nonetheless, the long-term result of the Condon Committee's investigation into unidentified flying objects was that the scientific community never took that subject very seriously. But going back even earlier, when people like, or rather when agencies like the Air Force did take it very seriously, when there were scientific organizations that were actively pursuing knowledge with regard to what was underlying the UFO problem, when we look back to the Project Blue Book years, we do see that there were a number of people who supposed, well, maybe what we're dealing with is something that is extraterrestrial. For all we know, that is as good an explanation as anything else, and it very well may be that these aircraft are something from another planet. In which case, of course, contact, as Mr. Sagan would have said, seemed imminent. And here we are, it's 2012... If the Mayans are right, the world's going to end this year before we ever make contact with the aliens. But are they really aliens? You know, are they really aliens? That's that seems to be the greater question there. And so when it comes to the idea of ancient aliens and cosmology, bringing this back around to the Smithsonian article here, I'm not saying that it's impossible that Earth was ever visited by intelligent species, but I'm certainly saying that we don't seem to have evidence of that occurring right now. A lot of people assert that the UFO problem is synonymous with extraterrestrial intelligence that may have visited Earth and may be continuing surveys and visitation of Earth right now, in the modern sense. I spoke to an astronomer. In fact, he was an astronomy professor. I think I've mentioned this before. In fact, I know I have on this program. And he's an astronomy professor at a college here in Western North Carolina. And I asked him once, I said, what is your take on the extraterrestrial hypothesis? I thought, hey, he's an astronomer. He'd be a good guy to talk to about this. And the professor in question told me, I don't think that, again, scientifically, I can say that there's any evidence for that right now. There's no scientific evidence. Well, there may be evidence, but there's absolutely no proof that we've been visited. But what there is, indeed, is the potential that we may have been visited long ago. And he said that I think that if ever humankind had ever been visited here on planet Earth by aliens from another land, another galaxy in our universe, in all likelihood, that must have happened a long time ago. Interesting that, and again, this seems to be something that is highly acceptable in scientific groups and in the scientific and the academic circles. The notion of, I think Sagan was the very one that referred to it as paleocontact, a term I prefer to use as well. Maybe we were visited in ancient times, but the concept of UFOs having some direct relation to extraterrestrials in the modern sense just seems too far out there. I happen to agree with that notion to an extent. I won't rule out any possibility, but I don't think that the likelihood with regard to UFOs being extraterrestrial in origin is very good. I just think that indeed it could be that that's the case, just not the most likely aspect. And yet people in academic circles do seem to be more comfortable with saying, what if we were visited in ancient times? That very well may be the case. And yet I do also see that by the same token, a lot of people issue or take issue with programs like Ancient Aliens. You know, Ancient Aliens is a program that indeed, Chris, like you pointed out, tends to take a far more, I don't think Hollywood is maybe the best term, but I mean, it's definitely got that kind of, you're like, don't talk about Hollywood like that, man. But I mean, but truly, the thing is that Ancient Aliens is a program that really does kind of focus more on the flashbang, what if, let's make it look good for the camera. Not that all the ideas put forth on that program are bad, but maybe they aren't the best presentation in terms of the ideological and intellectual pursuit of those sorts of avenues of thought.
Well, it's like I told you, when we first started doing this radio show, when I first started watching Ancient Aliens, you asked me what I thought about it, and I said, you know, if you are smart enough and have enough of a knowledge base and pay attention enough to sift through the 95% of it that's absolute crap and sensationalism, they do put forth quite a few really good points.
But
it's hidden. It's like a coded message within an entertainment television show, which if you're hip, you can pick it up.
Well, this blog at the Smithsonian website, I mean, it's hilarious. And again, the writer, Brian Swidick, it's so funny, some of the stuff he says here. And I'm not criticizing him. I mean, literally, his style of writing is hilarious, and I really enjoy it. He says, I'm actually glad that my editors don't allow me to cuss a blue streak on this blog. If they did, my entire review would be little more than a string of expletives. Given my restrictions, I have little choice but to try to encapsulate the shiny documentary format rubbish in a more coherent and reader-sensitive way. So he apparently refers to one specific episode here. I'm sorry, what?
Well, I was going to say he and I are in the same boat. My editor will not let me swear or cuss.
Who's your editor?
Either.
Harbo, right?
Harbo, yeah. Perennial Entertainment prohibits my really, really lexiconic use of profanity. I mean, seriously, I know so many cuss words.
I'll bet
in
you do.
So many different languages, too.
You know, I have to say, Red Pill Junkie in the chat room just said, but Ancient Aliens is like Citizen Kane compared to Battleship.
Oh, my God. I just can't wait. I cannot wait to see Liam Neeson, just a close-up on Liam Neeson's face. You sunk my battleship.
Does he actually say that in the film?
No, but, I mean, I don't know.
It probably will.
It's not in the preview. Oh, I mean, the intro to the preview says, brought to you by Hasbro, the people who brought you Transformers and other movies that Michael Bay ruined.
Oh my gosh. Okay, we'll get it. Coming back to this Smithsonian blog, this is hilarious. The blogger writes that the episode we're talking about here is what you would get if you dropped some creationist propaganda, along with Eric Von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods, and then stock footage from Jurassic Fight Club into a blender. Wait, Jurassic Fight Club?
Have you never seen Jurassic Fight Club?
Oh, God.
Oh, my God, it's so good. They basically replicate and simulate who would win in a fight between things like saber-toothed tiger and velociraptor. And just really ridiculous things like mammoth and...
Oh, wait, this
Phoenixes.
Is a television show.
Yeah.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah,
see, I thought
really
that was good. I didn't know that that's what it was called, though. I thought that was like a misprint there. I thought they meant Jurassic Park and Fight Club. Well, anyway, he says, what results is a slimy and incomprehensible mixture of idle speculation and outright fabrications which pit the enthusiastic, air quotes here, ancient alien theorists, as the narrator generously calls them, against mainstream science. I would say you can't make this stuff up, but I have a feeling that that is exactly what most of the show's personalities were doing. There was so much wrong with the Ancient Aliens episode that I could spend all week trying to counteract every incorrect assertion. Now, I have to say that, granted, this guy's made it clear that he's only watched one episode.
He apparently has not seen Aliens in the Third Reich, because, well, the first season, I don't know how versed everyone is, the first season of Ancient Aliens was awesome, because each episode was nearly 2 hours long.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was really good. Like, really good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How good was it, Chris?
I watched the whole first two seasons in 2 days.
Hmm. I think that was really good. Anyway, I was going to pull my Barry White voice, but... Well, he says the... Chris is having a hard
time. I just got this image of Micah, like, seeing...
With an afro.
With an afro. Seeing Giorgio Tsoukalos at Paradigm and singing Can't Get Enough of Your Love.
Matt, like, why you would know, you think that?
Because
that's
you're
my
the
job.
One bringing up Barry White.
What is wrong with this
if
guy?
If anyone's going to make Giorgio Tsoukalos feel uncomfortable at the show, it's going to be me.
Would you just push some buttons over there, Matt? Would you just do your job? Would you just do the show? Do the show.
So is Alex Jones here?
All right,
again?
You convinced me.
Anyway, as I was trying to say, this is a common technique, okay, as described again by Brian here in this article. He says that it's a common technique that is used by these personalities, as he refers to them, in terms of trying to... Sorry, I'm trying not to laugh at this too much here. He says it's a common technique that cranks and self-appointed challengers of science use, called the Gish Gallop, after young Earth creationist Dwayne Gish. He's referring specifically to trying to present their pseudoscientific arguments and appearing as though they are standing athwart the mainstream by doing so. He says, when giving public presentations about evolution and creationism, Gish would rapidly spout off a series of misinterpretations and falsehoods to bury his opponent under an avalanche of fictions and distortions. If Gish's opponent tried to dig themselves out, they would never be able to make enough progress to free themselves to take on Gish directly. Brian asserts here that Ancient Aliens uses the same tactic. The fictions come fast and furious. And while the main point of the episode that he watched was that aliens exterminated dinosaurs to make way for our species, well, I'm glad we finally got that worked out. We've been worrying about what killed the dinosaurs, and we wouldn't even be here if the aliens hadn't done it for us. Ah, God, those aliens always having to cover up, always having to take care of our dirty work for us. He says, a sci-fi scenario accompanied by some hilarious mashed-together footage of dinosaurs fleeing from strafing alien craft. He says, perhaps a preview of Dinosaurs versus Aliens, the movie, If it weren't for all this, he says, the various ancient alien experts do little more than assert that such an event must have happened. Surprise, surprise, they provide no actual evidence for their claims. Instead, they borrow evidence from fundamentalist Christians, I suppose he meant, who are never actually identified as such. Creationist Michael Cremo is identified only as the author of Forbidden Archaeology, and Willie E. Dye is credited as a biblical archaeologist without any mention of his young Earth creationist views. Ancient Aliens producers clearly did not care about the credentials or expertise of the talking heads they employed, just so long as someone said that the right things, or rather said those things in front of the camera.
This guy's railing against the wrong thing. Yes, Ancient Aliens is credulous, because it's a television show. It is a television show, as I've explained, and it is entertainment. What needs to be railed against are things that people actually believe and start churches over, like Scientology. there are alien molecules in your body because they were put in volcanoes a long time ago, and you've got to, you've got to grab onto
Thetans.
This thing. Your soul has to be audited, and you have to pay a lot of money to have it audited.
$200,000.
And people believe this and indoctrinate their children in this and indoctrinate their family in this and donate all of their livelihoods to this.
Yes.
Why are you getting on me or Giorgio Tsoukalos or the producers?
Okay, good point.
Or the producers from History Channel for putting on a TV show. It's a TV show.
But again, Chris, I'll say this too.
I don't see a Church of Ancient Aliens happening. I don't see a church of super awesome hair going on, unless you count the Church of the Fawns.
I couldn't have said it better.
Which I subscribe to wholeheartedly.
But the thing is I think that, and this is something we have to take into consideration too, which seems more plausible, okay, those kinds of theories proposed by the Scientologists, or the possibility that indeed, and I'm not speaking, again, I think maybe Brian here got a bad, and I'm not trying to justify anything that you may hear or see or smell for that matter while watching an episode of Ancient Aliens, okay?
I have synesthesia, so thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, right?
I can smell the colors.
But what I am trying to say here, to the contrary, is that although one episode, and again, what are we, three seasons into this? One episode may be a bit lacking. Four.
It's on the fourth season. Right now it's premiering on H2, formerly History International, but okay, will soon be on the regular History Channel. Boom.
Okay, well, four seasons into this program, I'm sorry, they're probably scraping at this point, trying to get information and concepts and ideas for new episodes together. Which is understandable because it's entertainment.
Well, you would think that, but you'd be wrong.
Okay. Yeah. Well, okay, but regardless of that for a minute, let's just say this. If that's the case, then is the underlying concept, in other words, the name of the program, Ancient Aliens, is that not still, whether or not it's actually whatever happened in our ancient past, is that still not something worth consideration? Is it? Is it worth consideration? I think so. But again, let's juxtapose that alongside the Church of Scientology for a moment. I don't want to attack anybody. Hey, if that's your belief, fantastic, great, you know?
You may not want to, but I'm all for attacking the Church of Scientology.
Well, are you anonymous? You are anonymous, aren't you?
No, I'm not anonymous. I'm logical.
Well, the point I'm trying to make here again is that if we have to put the two against one another, the general philosophical premise behind Ancient Aliens is worthy of consideration. We'll consider some more things here when we come back here on the Graylian Report.
Bob Tarmack from InceptionRadioNetwork.com. I'm going to clue you into a show that I listen to every single week. It's Inception Radio with Jamie Hannigan. It airs Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Jamie always brings on new guests every single week on a variety of topics. UFOs, it's paranormal, it's time travel, conspiracy theory, it's everything. And Jamie covers it in depth. When this begins, it's Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. I'll see you there.
program. Micah Hanks here. It is the Graylian Report, my friends. If you managed to find this website, I can't talk tonight. Chris, would you just talk for me? Tell people how the hell they can find this program, please.
You can find us by going to www.graylianreport.com. That's G-R-A-L-I-E-N report.com. Or alternately, you can find us on Ustream every Tuesday night from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Well, no, now 10 p.m. Eastern. Yeah. At www.ustream.tv/channel/Micah-Hanks.
Listen to this guy right
Back
here.
Back to you, Micah.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, indeed. Yes, this program, you can, in fact, if you've found us on iTunes, that's probably where most people find this program. If you find this program on iTunes and you haven't looked at the website, do check out www.graylianreport.com. And that said, we've rambled enough about ancient aliens. Chris, now this is something that's really, let's get down to the good stuff right here.
Wait, there's stuff better than ancient aliens?
Hardly, but we're gonna act like there are just for the last 5 minutes of the program to give people a breather, if you will. Do you remember the old 1960s Batman and Robin movie? You remember that?
Yeah, repellent, dude.
Shark repellent, right? That opening sequence where Batman's like hanging on the ladder, and he's got the shark repellent,
and it's like all the way up his leg.
Like, is it? I'm sorry, this is another movie I've never seen. Is it like a spray or?
He pulls out from his bat belt. He pulls out like a spray that's shark repellent.
Does it say shark repellent on the? Wow, just in case.
Batman always has trusty shark repellent on his utility belt.
Oh, well, God. I mean, he would. He's rich.
That is a classic. Oh God. Anyway, point being. If only Batman had known that he didn't have to carry this patented Wayne Enterprises shark repellent, he could have used magnets and apparently gotten the same effect.
Yeah, he probably had shark repellent on him already and didn't need to double up. Redundancy, guys. That's what kills superheroes.
Exactly. That or sharks that, well, apparently haven't...
Aren't repelled.
Yeah, well, there you go. Non-repelled sharks kill superheroes. But if Batman had had magnets, he could have warded off that dangerous circumstance, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And this actually comes from the BBC, so you know it's credible. the article's entitled, Shark Attacks, a magnetic solution? And it seems that there is, in fact, a magnetic solution to shark attacks, or at the very least, lemon shark attacks. Anyway...
Lemon shark. Is this a specific kind of shark? Lemon sharks?
Yeah, lemon sharks.
Are they
sharks.
Yellow?
I don't think so. Juice them? I'll go ahead and get to that. No. I mean, you can,
but if they were
going to
be yellow sharks, they could have also been called banana sharks.
They could be, but...
It was just about a color, but anyway, go ahead.
Well, yeah, thanks. Anyway, American chemist Eric Stroud has... come up with an idea. Well, not come up with an idea. It was kind of accidental. He and his wife were on a cruise in 2001, and due to bad weather, they were stuck in their cabin for days. And he said all he saw on television was shark attack after shark attack after shark attack. He said it seemed like every person in Florida who stepped foot into the ocean was being bitten by a shark. Hmm. So his wife thought, well, why don't you come up with an idea for a shark repellent? Seeing as he's a chemist, he could make an aerosol spray.
Right.
So,
he worked for Wayne Enterprises, didn't he?
Yes. Sooner or later, his basement at home was just filled with pools, like kiddie pools that had sharks in each one. You know, nurse sharks, lemon sharks, different smaller sharks that wouldn't bite your hand off. And one day, he was working in his lab and dropped a magnet in the water on accident, and he noticed that the nurse sharks, as soon as the magnet hit the water, like bolted to the sides of the pen.
Hmm.
And so he left it in there and noticed that the nurse sharks wouldn't go near this magnet. They were like almost terrified of the magnet. So now he has come up with a fish hook that basically is a magnet wrapped in some kind of foil. But it's a magnet hook. And what it does is the electromagnetism that comes off a magnet naturally is picked up by the little...
Wait, hold on. Is this electromagnetism?
No, it's magnetism, but okay. Magnets put out an electric current naturally in water, in salt water.
Okay.
Yes. And sharks can pick up electrical impulses with special glands mm-hmm. in their snouts, and these magnets are interfering with that and... making the sharks uncomfortable, and they don't like it, so they're staying away.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So these sharks are managing Very interesting stuff. And who knew that it would be as simple as just employing a magnet as opposed to having to have that trusty shark repellent? I don't know. I don't know if I'd want to take that chance. But then again, of course, I'm also not, you know, hanging off of a ladder from the bat copter as I'm flying out over God knows what body of water. On behalf of all of us here at Grelia International, Chris Hayes, Matt Oakley, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Holly, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South, we bid you adieu, my friends, and until next time, stay strange. We'll talk to you soon.